You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Imperial for November 29th. I'm Allie Wixom from Drake University. Here is our first story. Giving Tuesday is November 29th. What you need to know to show support to your favorite causes. Share Iowa. This year, Giving Tuesday is November 29th, and the community is encouraged to visit Share Iowa to find and support over 130 area nonprofits. Giving Tuesday is a global day of giving and the biggest giving day of the year in the region. In 2021, an amazing $2.3 million was raised in Western Iowa for Giving Tuesday, according to a press release from the Community Foundation for Western Iowa. This, combined with donations made in Omaha metropolitan area, totaled $5.5 million in Giving Tuesday supporting for our region. Share Iowa, an initiative of the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, is a one-step donation platform that launched in September of 2022 to support the Community Foundation's 9-county service area in Western Iowa. Share Iowa is a key resource for our community members far and wide to connect to causes and communities that they are passionate about. Donna Dostal, President and CEO of the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, said in a press release, "We are thrilled to offer this dynamic tool to our nonprofits to engage their donors and supporters, especially during this giving season and Giving Tuesday 712 sponsored by our friends at TS Blank. This year, the Community Foundation has a $250,000 pool of funds for a 20% match on gifts to endowment funds within the foundation. The 20% match is on giving up $100,000 per fund, and after the pool is used, the match will go to 10%. Nonprofit organizations with an endowment fund with the Community Foundation can have supporters donate directly to their endowment fund through Share Iowa. Additionally, with the help of community members and small business partners, TS Bank is hosting 2 supply drives for Giving Tuesday. The bank is collecting diapers to be delivered to area nonprofits and children's hats and gloves for local elementary schools. Donations can be dropped off at any TS Bank location in the area. TS Bank's 45 Scott Street location in Council Bluffs will also be the heart for Giving Tuesday 712. Community members who are interested in making donations to their favor causes are encouraged to visit TS Bank on Giving Tuesday if they would like to have a check presentation. Community members who are interested in making donations to their favorite causes are encouraged to visit TS Bank on Giving Tuesday if they would like to have a check presentation and celebrate the culture of giving in Western Iowa. TS Bank prioritizes community investment. Since 2007, it has made nearly $5 million in grants. Giving is one of our community's core principles and one we will always stand behind, said Kelsey Dupful, TS Bank Director of Public Relations. We love seeing firsthand each community harness their local strengths for positive change. The Community Foundation for Western Iowa is also hosting a Giving Tuesday celebration at Full-Fledged Brewing, 40 Arena Way, Suite 2, from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday. All are welcome to attend. Donors are encouraged to visit shareiowa.org to find new nonprofits to support in addition to their favorite cause based organizations. ISD Reach Out addresses regions, resources needed for deaf, hard of hearing students. Tim Johnson. In this article, there is a picture of a woman signing, which says Tina Khalid, Outreach Director, Iowa School for Deaf, signs her remarks at the Iowa Board of Regents while an interpreter translates. Iowa has an estimated 3,100 deaf or hard of hearing children, and not all of them have access to the services they need, according to Tina Khalid, Outreach Director at the Iowa School for the Deaf. She spoke at the Iowa Board of Regents during its recent meeting at ISD and to the non-imperial after the meeting. Christine Oxier and Amanda Jewell of Green Hills Area Education Agency teach deaf and hard of hearing students from birth to age 21, although fewer beyond high school age, they said in a separate conversation about the AEA's work with deaf and hard of hearing students. The agency has 4 teachers who serve students in different parts of its 15-county area, as well as 4 audiologists who perform hearing tests to identify students who may be deaf or hard of hearing. Last year, there were 280 known deaf and hard of hearing students in Green Hills Territory, Oxier said. Of those, 78 attended Iowa School for the Deaf. 170 had individual education plans, 6 had individual family support plans, and 31 had plans that called for multiple services. With IEPs and IFSPs, there are teams that collaboratively decide which services a child needs and how they should be delivered, said Ivan Gentry, Executive Director of Specialized Services and Supports at Green Hills. Audiologists help determine what, if any, special equipment might be helpful to a child, Jewel said. The school's districts are the ones who would buy the school-based equipment that would use within the classroom, she said. A child may need to work with a language pathologist, Gentry said. Students who continue to receive services after finishing high school have other unmet needs, he said. The agency provides information to students and families about other resources in the community, such as vocational rehabilitation, Oxer says. However, Khaled is concerned about students learning language. Some parents of deaf children do not know American Sign Language, she said. Last year, 330 people registered for ASO classes through ISD. Half were family members and 1.5% were people from AEAs. Our families love these classes, she said. ISD has an outreach assessment team that serves children beginning at age 3, Khaled says. Of the students tested, 56 were high school students and 39% were middle school students. The goal of assessments is to identify students who need more services. We do not need to have an interpreter program in Iowa, except at Scott County Community College, she said. As a result, there are 7 vacancies in the state that remain unfilled, Callum says. Students who don't have interpreters tend not to learn as much at school, she said. We have deaf learning mentors who work with these students, and schools are desperate for these mentors, she said. These mentors are deaf people who have good language skills and some teaching experience, Khaled says. Some attend ISD. Many students go through elementary and middle school years, and then the school figures out they need mentoring, she said. You have to figure out what early learning experience in order for them to succeed in high school. ISD offers ASL instruction for staff members and also for teachers around the state, Khaled said. They have literacy resources for ASL that are on videos. In 2021, the outreach team started choosing children's books to translate into American Sign Language, and ISD set up studio and hired videographers, Khaled said. So far, they have translated 47 books. Teachers love this resource, she said. We have a waiting list of books to translate. The videos are distributed through YouTube, Khaled said. The fair use policy allows the development of free teaching resources. We do not sell them, she said. We are not supporting teachers. We are supporting teachers in the work they are doing. Many deaf and hard of hearing children miss early opportunities for language development. Khaled said that in 97% of the homes with hard of hearing students, parents only use spoken language. Some kids do not benefit from spoken language, she said, depending on how much they can hear. Those who do not succeed with spoken language don't have anything else. Khaled said they encourage parents to use both spoken language and ASL. That exposure really is what is critical, she said. Iowa's area educational agencies do not have enough staff who can teach ASL and work with students, Khaled said. They are spread too thin, which means they have too little time with each student. Some deaf and hard of hearing students see a teacher only once a week for 20 minutes, she said. Some students have interpreters, while others have paraeducators with equipments or cards, Khaled said. We really see it run the gamut, she said. Some students have no language, while others have language but struggle with concept, Khaled said. It's difficult for hearing people to explain concepts to a deaf person because they don't think like a deaf person, she said. Khaled said she doesn't know how many deaf and hard of hearing children are missing language developments they need. Since August, we have seen 15 students across the state who desperately need these services. She said, "We try everywhere, schools reach out to us, and we go." House File 604, which passed this year, relates to language and literacy development for deaf children birth to age 8 or 9, Khaled said. Under HF 604, information on children's hearing and struggles to understand language must be shared with parents. Parents need to learn what the language milestones are for both ASL and English so they'll see where their child is, she said. Parents can ask their child's school or ISD for services. Khaled said she and ISD interim superintendent John Cole discussed establishing the outreach program, and the previous superintendent at ISD checked with the regents. They approved setting it up. They have been supportive from day one, she said. Khaled grew up in a small town and rode a bus 1.5 hours to Waterloo, where the school system had a large deaf education program. Waterloo no longer has a large program like that, she says. Des Moines does, but it cannot serve all the students from the surrounding area. I really feel it's important to have a deaf education programs in big cities, she said. When she was ready for high school, she insisted her parents send her to ISD. She sent her children to ISD, and before that, to the Indiana School for the Deaf. Close Linn County State House race to be recounted. Wynette versus Wilson race is one of three Iowa House races to be contested. Cedar Rapids. A bipartisan three-member board will recount ballots cast in the close Linn County State House race starting today, one of three legislative races being recounted statewide where Democrats won according to unofficial results. Democrat Elizabeth Wilson edged Republican Susie Wynette by 305 votes out, more than 14,000 votes counted in the November 8th election for an open seat in Iowa House District 73, according to unofficial results. Wynette, a former Cedar Rapids City Council member, requested a recount of ballots in all 16 precincts with the district, including absentee ballots. The district covers a portion of southeast Cedar Rapids and much northern and eastern Marion. The Linn County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved a motion Monday to order a recount of votes for the District 73 election, a formality required by Iowa law, said Matt Warfield, Linn County Deputy Commissioner of Elections. Wynette did not respond to messages seeking comment Monday afternoon. Warfield said Wynette did not provide a reason for requesting a recount. Wilson, while surprised, acknowledged Wynette's right to a recount and said she does not expect it will change the results. "I don't know her particular rationale for the recount," Wilson, a former Linmar school board member, said of Wynette. "It's all within her purview to do that. I don't feel worried about it." Often, recounts don't change more than a few dozen votes. In 2020, a total of 41 votes changed out of nearly 400,000 ballots cast during a district-wide recount in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, which spanned 24 counties. In 2018, vote recounts in two close Iowa House races did not change the outcome of the elections, and recounts in three other Iowa House races this year across the state did not change the winner. Under Iowa law, a candidate can request a recount up to 3 days after the county board's canvass of the election, which was November 15th. Wynette submitted her request for a recount on November 17th. Because the race's margin was more than 1% of the total number of ballots casted, Wynette paid a $150 bond to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Per Iowa law, a three-person volunteer recount board that includes representatives chosen by each candidate will convene starting at 8 a.m. to conduct the recount, said Warfield. Auditor's office staff does not conduct the actual counting in a candidate-requested recount, but instead supervises as a custodian of the ballots. Wynette selected James Conklin of Marion, a former Linn County Republican Party Central Committee chair, to be her representative on the board. Wilson chose Linda Langston, a former Linn County supervisor, as her representative. Both Cooklin and Langston chose Cedar Rapids lawyer Frank Milvatsky as their third member. Conklin said he does not expect to find enough votes to overturn the result of the race, but that's not the reason. He cited what deemed to be serious issues on Election Day by the Linn County Auditor's Office, including erroneously leaving an election for a county supervisor off the ballot in one precinct and an error reporting its early vote counts. I'm trying to help make sure the ballot box is safe, Conklin said. I don't trust our auditor, and when I was asked to serve on the recount board, I jumped at it. According to the Linn County Auditor's Office, a computer froze while the county's absentee ballots counts were being uploaded on election night. The process was completed on a backup computer, but officials believe 600 ballots were inadvertently reported twice, once during the original attempt and again during the backup attempt. Discrepancy was discovered by Iowa Secretary of State's office, which then alerted the Linn County Auditor's Office. The auditor's office resolved the tabulation, and the posted results were corrected, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Sounds to me like there are great checks and balances in place to make sure that the election is accurate, Wilson said. The recount board's first order of business will be to decide whether to recount votes by hand, by machines used on election day, or both, Warfield said. Under Iowa's recount laws, the board can determine precinct by precinct if they want to do a hand count, machine recount, or both, according to Iowa Secretary of State's office. A hand count will allow the board to gauge intent if a voter failed to properly mark by ballot, such as circling a candidate's name instead of filling in the oval next to their name, or crossing out a mistake in section and filling in the correct one. But a hand count of all the precincts would be a time-consuming and involve roughly 45,000 ballots, Warfield said. That includes sorting through some 280,700 absentee ballots again to determine which early votes cast ballot in the state house race. Warfield estimated a machine recount would be complete within 2 days, where a hand recount would be a struggle to finish by a state-imposed deadline of 5 p.m. Monday. By comparison, a hand recount of roughly 8,000 ballots cast last year in a Marion City complete race took 3 days to complete, Warfield said. The State Board of Canvassers will meet Thursday to certify state election results. Any recount that has not been done will not be included, and a separate special canvass will occur, said Kevin Hall, communications director for the Iowa Secretary of State. Republican candidates have also requested recounts in two other Iowa House district races where they closely trail Democrats. Republican Doug Campbell requested a recount in District 49 in Cerro Gordo County, where he trails Democrat Sharon Steckman by 739 votes out of 11,922 cast. A three-member recount board began recounting votes Monday morning and is expected to finish by the end of the week, said Cerro Gordo County Auditor Adam Woodmore. In Scott County, Republican Luann Stoltenberg requested a recount scheduled in the beginning today. In Scott County, Republican Luann Stoltenberg requested a recount scheduled to begin today in District 81. On election night, Stoltenberg appeared to be ahead by 29 votes, but following a week of administrative recounts of the county's absentee ballots, Democrat Craig Cooper took the lead by 6 votes. The administrative recounts there, called for by county auditor and Iowa Secretary of State, were prompted by a discrepancy of nearly 500 absentee ballots found in the tallies on election night. Stoltenberg requested a recount last week, telling a reporter the Scott's County tallies didn't appear and reconcile even after the records. Face of the day, courtesy Milan's Humane Society, Brock the Cat, shows a cat in black and white, which appears to be some sort of calico cat. After being brought in off the streets, Brock the Cat is hoping to find his forever home soon. Brock is a 2-year-old male domestic shorthair who is currently available for adoption at Milan's Humane Society. Shelter staff members say he was brought in as a stray earlier this month, but he's quickly warmed up to everyone at Milan's. He doesn't delay when giving out affection, and he'd be a great lap cat in a loving household. His adoption fee is $95, which covers a microchip, altering, and age-appropriate vaccines. In other shelter news, Midlands just kicked off its annual Bark Friday fundraising campaign. They have a goal of $50,000 this year, and they're asking area animal lovers to pitch in from now until the end of 2022. Cash, check, and credit card donations can be made to the shelter 020 Railroad Ave, or on their website. More information about fostering, volunteering, and donating opportunities can be found at MidlandHumaneSociety.org or by calling 712-396-2270, like their Facebook page, to keep up with daily shelter news. The shelter can also be found at Midland Humane on Twitter and at Midland Humane Society on Instagram. California drought hurts Iowa beekeepers. Mount Vernon, Iowa. Some Iowa beekeepers make extra money by taking their bees to California for the winter to pollinate almond trees, but that work is literally drying up with the drought on the West Coast. Some of the old orchards are being torn out, said Phil Ebert, 80, founder of Ebert Honey, with operations in Mount Vernon and Linville. We've lost our spot out there, and I don't know if we're going to be able to find another one. California, which produces 80% of the world's almonds, has long relied on honeybees for pollination because most almond tree variants do not self-pollinate, said Josette Lewis, chief scientific officer with the Almond Board of California. California beekeepers provide about one-third of the bees for almond pollination because almonds have exploded in popularity in the past 25 years because the pollination window is only about a month. California almond growers must recruit beekeepers from other states. A large portion come from the western parts of the United States, but honeybees come from all over the country, Lewis told the Cedar Rapids Gazette. That has increasingly been an attractive feature for beekeepers. Not only do almond growers pay about $200 per colony of bees for the season, bees that help with almond pollination get a feast of pollen and nectar that much earlier in the season than bees overwintering in Iowa. The real benefit is when the bees come home and the boxes are full, Ebert says. This means he can split the hive to form more colonies and increase honey production. But 3 years into a drought, California's 2022 almond harvest was estimated to be 11% below last year, with a projected yield of 1,900 pounds per acre, the lowest since 2009, according to the U.S. Department of Agricultural report produced in July. Almond producers are in a painful position where we have both limited water resources, and if you do get water, you'll be paying a higher price as well as higher input costs, Lewis says. All of this happened at a time when almond prices had been really low, predominantly due to supply chain problems. California's Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which went into effect in 2021, prohibits farmers from pumping too much water from underground aquifers, NPR reports. This law and other market forces have caused some California almond growers to remove trees, Lewis said. We did see a small uptick in the amount of almond orchards removed. probably as a result of the drought, she said. There are certain areas of the state that will face long-term restrictions on water. Going forward, that remains something we'll keep a watch on as we go into another year of strained profitability. Fewer acres of almonds means less of a need for honeybee pollinators. The Eberts have transported honeybees to California the last 4 years, trucking hundreds of colonies to almond groves in November or December, so they're trucking hundreds of colonies to almond groves in November or December, so the bees are ready for almond pollination in February and March. If they can't get a spot in California, the Eberts might take their bees to Texas. They won't get paid there, but the bees would start getting pollen in January versus March or April in Iowa, Eberts said. In either state, the Eberts would have to go out in January and early February to feed the bees and maintain the hives. I'm still trying to get them to California, said Adam Ebert, one of Phil's sons. The almond pollination pays really well. The USDA announced this week it will resume a survey of farmers to see who is using honeybees pollinators and how much it costs. Data from the survey, discontinued in 2018 because of USDA budget constraints, helps produce, develop their budgets, and provide documentation for crop insurance, Lewis says. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Allie Wixom from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Obituaries. Vernon Ralph Morehouse. Vernon Routh Morehouse, age 97, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away November 26, 2022. He was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa, on January 3, 1925, to Roy and Ethel Clark Morehouse. He was a World War II veteran in the USA Army, truck driver, and a member of Team Masters Local 554. Vernon enjoyed playing cards, bowling, and having coffee with friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Merle and Cleo Morehouse, and sister Bernice Jocelyn. Vernon is survived by wife Norma, son David Morehouse, daughter Rhonda Powell, grandchildren David II, Adam and Rachel, sister Elaine Hurd, nieces, nephews, and other family friends. Funeral service, 11 a.m., Friday, December 2nd, 2022, with visitation 1 hour prior at Hoy Colon Psych Funeral Home. Intermittent Memorial Park Ceremony. Memorials may be directed to Every Step Hospice or the family. Mary E. Grote. Mary E. Grote, age 69, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 27, 2022, at Bethany Lutheran Home. Mary was born May 25th, 1953, in Harlan, Iowa, to the late J.D. and Catherine E. Von Search Miles. She graduated from Harlan Community High School in 1971 and earned her nursing degree from IWCC in 1987. Mary married Michael F. Grote on April 22, 1972, in Portsmouth, Iowa. They were blessed with three children, Todd, Adam, and Emily. The Grotes made their home in Portsmouth before moving to Council Bluff in 1997. Mary was an RN at Jenny Edmundson Hospital for 32 years, retiring in 2019. She was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Council Bluffs. In addition to her parents, Mary was preceded in death by her grandson Damien, sister Connie Heller, and brother John Miles. Mary is survived by her husband of 50 years, Michael Grotes of Council Bluffs, sons Todd Grote of Harlan, Adam Grote of Atlantic, Iowa, daughter Emily Benson of Council Bluffs, two grandchildren, Dakota and Grace, four sisters, Bonnie Doyle of Littleton, Colorado, Janice Gow of Erling, Iowa, Carol Rischling of Omaha, Peggy Linton of Fort Calhoun, Nebraska, brother-in-law Bernie Heller of Council Bluffs, nieces and nephews. Wake service Thursday 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Ballas Park Chapel. Memorial Mass Friday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church with a nursing tribute by the Jenny Edmundson Nurse Honor Guard. Interment in St. Joseph Cemetery with a lunch following at the St. Patrick Parish Hall. Memorials are suggested to St. Patrick's Church. Dale Stark. Dale Stark, dedicated husband, father, and grandfather, and friend, passed away peacefully at Mercy Hospital, Council Bluffs, Iowa, on Saturday, November 26, at the age of 80. Dale was born on January 29, 1942, in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, to Absalom Hayden and Hattie Kane Stark. He was one of seven children born to Hayden and Hattie. He graduated from Uniontown High School in 1959 before enlisting in the United States Navy, where he served his country proudly until his retirement in 1977. After his retirement from the Navy, Dale went back to school where he earned his BA in accounting from Buena Vista University. Dale spent his second career working as a comptroller before he officially retired for the second time in 2004. Dale was blessed with a large and loving family. He married his wife, Carol, on August 7, 1971. Their romance lasted all 51 years. Dale was blessed with a large and loving family. He married his wife, Carol, on August 7, 1971. Their romance lasted all 51 years and was blessed with five wonderful children, eight grandchildren, and nine great-great-grandchildren. Dale's favorite time was spent with family. Dale was a proud member of the Masonic Choral Lodge No. 355 AF and AM and the Order of the White Shrine of Jerusalem, locally and nationally. Dale also spent countless hours volunteering for church and fire department activities over the years. After his second retirement, Dale became obsessed with playing bridge, where he enjoyed meeting new people and playing in many clubs in Council Bluffs and Omaha. Dale had a relationship with God, and his family is positive that he's enjoying a good game in heaven. Dale was preceded by his father, Absalom Hayden Stark, mother Hattie Stark, brothers Francis Raymond and James J.C. Stark, sister Mary Catherine Spencer, sister-in-laws Jackie and Shirley Stark, mother and father-in-law Louis Bud and Velma Lucille Rhodes, and grandson Christopher Bauman. Dale is survived by his wife Carol, their children Francis Stark, Sandra Rahman, Shelby Hall, Ricky Stark, and Paula Hazelwood, brothers Calvin Stark, Richard Dick Stark, 7 grandchildren and 9 great-great-children, numerous nieces, nephews, and friends. A celebration of life and memorial service will be held on Friday, December 2nd from 3 to 5 at Cutler O'Neill Funeral Home, 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503, with a meal to follow at Salem United Methodist Church, 14955 Somerset Avenue, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Salem Methodist Church. James Anthony Aparo. James Anthony Aparo, age 63, Council Bluffs, passed away November 28, 2022, at home with his family by his side. Born in Omaha, Nebraska on April 10, 1959 to Antonio and Clara Aparo, and on November 22, 1977, he was united in marriage to Vicki Nunes. Jim was passionate about cooking, always cooking for his family. He loved boxing, music, and taking care of his family working as a home remodeler. He was preceded in death by his father Antonio, brother Joe Aparo, sister Mary Ellen Briceno, grandmother Rose Hogan, sister-in-law Linda Gustin, brother-in-law Leonard Nunes, and father-in-law Blaze Nunes. Jim was survived by his wife Vicki, sons James Aparo II, both of Council Bluffs, Jesse Aparo of Omaha, daughter Amanda Aparo, La Vista, Nebraska, 10 grandchildren, 1 great-grandchild, mother and stepfather Clara and Vince Briceno, brother John Aparo, sisters Clara Hobbs, Joyce Aparo, LaVon Rosar, all Council Bluffs, Anna McKinney, Bellevue, nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family Wednesday 5 to 7 p.m. Funeral and services Thursday 11 a.m. all at the funeral home. A luncheon will follow in the Cutler O'Neill Community Room. Greg Foster. Greg Foster was born August 30th, 1949. He entered into rest on November 13th, 2022 at the Missouri Valley Hospital. A celebration of life service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, December 3rd, 2022 at Broadway United Methodist Church. Memorials are suggested to Broadway United Methodist Church. South Carolina stays unanimous number one. South Carolina remained the unanimous number one choice in the Associated Press women's basketball poll released Monday as the Gamecocks keep close watch on the foot injury of reigning player of the year, Aliyah Boston. The Gamecocks received all 29 first place votes in the poll released Monday, a day after Boston left the game with her injury. Coach Don Stanley said Boston was questionable going forward, but added that the team doctor wasn't too concerned. South Carolina's next game is Tuesday at home against number 15 UCLA. Stanford remained number 2 after cruising through a tournament in Hawaii. It's the 618th appearance for Cardinal coach Tara Van Der Veer, tying the late Pat Summitt for most all time. Summitt's team only missed being in the poll 14 times during her Hall of Fame career in Tennessee. UConn, Ohio State, and Indiana rounded out the top 5. The Huskies are one of 4 Big East teams to be ranked this week as Marquette entered the poll at number 24. It's the first time the Big East has four ranked teams since the conference realigned in 2014. The league is 56-14 so far this season, including an 8-2 against ranked teams. We've been trying to earn a little more respect, Marquette coach Megan Duffy said of the Big East, trying to schedule a tougher non-conference game. Nova's playing people. Us going to the Bahamas was great. Creighton's doing what they've been doing since last season. Getting some of those quality wins is everything. North Carolina moved up two spots to number 6 after rallying to beat then number 5 Iowa State in the Phil Knight tournament. The Cyclones fell to 8th. The Tar Heels visit the Hoosiers on Tuesday in the ACC Big Ten Challenge. Indiana returns home after winning two games in Las Vegas at a subpar venue that lacked basic necessities. Notre Dame remained number 7, while Virginia Tech and Iowa finished off the top 10. At number 9, Virginia Tech has matched its best ranking ever, and it's in the top 10 for the first time since 1999. Tennessee fell out of the poll this week, marking the 56th time in the 827th week history of the poll that the Lady Vols weren't ranked. Kansas State also fell out, with Gonzaga moving in at number 23. Falling Cardinals. Louisville dropped to 18th in the poll this week after falling to South Dakota State in the 5th place game at the Battle for Atlantis last week. It's the Cardinals' lowest ranking since January 11, 2016. Louisville had the longest active top 10 streak dating back to the preseason's poll in 2017, a span of 98 consecutive weeks. It's a compliment to the consistency that we built here, Louisville coach Jeff Wall said of being ranked in the top 10 for so long. Obviously, our goal would have been to stay in the top 10, but it's a new team and growing. College women's basketball. Reavers win 7 straight. Iowa Western defeats North Platte Community College. Iowa Western women's basketball won its 7th straight game on Saturday at North Platte Community College after Kayla Tye dropped 24 points in an 88-72 victory. Iowa Western jumped out to a 21-13 lead in the first quarter and stretched to the lead to 49-27 by halftime. Iowa Western continued to roll out the second half and led 69-43 by the end of the third. North Platte attempted a late rally and outscored Iowa Western 29-19 in the fourth, but it was too little too late. Iowa Western is now 7-0 on the season. Hannah Berg scored 13 points and Nadita Maka added 12. Elay Hurd grabbed a team-high 5 rebounds, and Michaela Huffine dished out 8 assists. Iowa Western will be in action next at 5:30 on Tuesday at Rochester Community and Technical College. Top-ranked Georgia motivated to end conference title drought. Athens, Georgia. Georgia's recent frustrations in the Southeastern Conference Championship games are providing extra motivation for the Bulldogs to remain focused this week. Saturday's matchup against number 11 LSU in Atlanta will be number 1 Georgia's 5th SEC Championship game in the last 6 seasons under Coach Kirby Smart. The Bulldogs' only SEC title in that span came in 2017 when they beat Auburn 28-7. Georgia is the defending national champion, but most players are looking for their first conference championship. The player said it's more than enough reason to avoid the temptation to look ahead at the 4-team college football playoff. It definitely means a lot to me, senior safety Chris Smith said Monday. It's definitely one of our team goals to be able to win the SEC. I've played in this game 3 times and haven't been able to win. Hopefully the 4th time is a charm. Georgia 12-0 number 1 CFP completed back-to-back undefeated regular seasons for the first time in school history with last week's 37-14 win over Georgia Tech. The Bulldogs sit atop the AP Top 25 for the 8th straight week. Georgia strengthened its case to be considered the successor to Alabama as the nation's most powerful program. Ending the streak of 3 consecutive SEC championship game losses would boost those bragging rights. The Bulldogs' recent record of futility in the SEC championship game includes a 37-10 loss to LSU in 2019. They gave us a beatdown and left a bitter taste in our mouths, Smith said. I was here for that, and that definitely gave me extra motivation for this game as well. A win over LSU would leave no doubt that about Georgia's position. A win over LSU would leave no doubt about Georgia's position atop the playoff rankings. The Bulldogs could make the 4-team playoff field even with a loss this week, but Smart says their first priority is winning the conference. He says there's no reason to think his players could be tempted to look ahead to the playoff. No, we're worried about winning the SEC championship, Smart said. That's the most important thing on our agenda, is to have an opportunity to do something that rarely gets done. I mean, it's tough to win an SEC championship. I've been part of this league for a long time. I have almost as many national championships as I do SEC championships. They are really hard to come by. We're focused on LSU. LSU coach Bryn Kelly said he thinks the SEC championship game will remain important even after the playoff expands to 12 teams. I think the conference championship still carries such a high school regard in college football and how they're perceived, Kelly said. I think in particular the SEC championship game. I think of that as such a big game and celebrated that I think that's always going to carry its place in college football. Georgia lost to Alabama 41-24 in last year's SEC championship game before beating the Crimson Tide to end a 41-year national title drought. Alabama also beat Georgia 35-28 in the 2018 SEC title game. The SEC championship game losses are an obvious void on the Bulldogs' otherwise impressive 7-year run with Smart. Smart is 1-1 in national championship games and 1-3 in SEC championship games at Georgia. It's more about checking a box, Smart said Monday before looking at the wall in the team's meeting room, which lists every year Georgia won a conference title. It's about that next step and having an opportunity to put a number on the wall that stays there forever. It's an SEC championship. You don't belittle those. Those are hard to come by. They're what you do for. I think our players take a lot of pride in that. College men's basketball. Houston reaches AP number one for first time since 1983. Make some room, Phi Slamma Jamma. Another Houston team has reached the top of men's college basketball. Nearly 4 decades after Clyde Drexler and Akeem Olajuwon took the Cougars to number one, the latest bunch led by Marcus Sasser and star freshman Jairus Walker took over top spot in the AP Top 25 on Monday. They received 45 of 63 first place votes from the national media panel, easily outdistancing second place Texas and third place Virginia. It's not like we went online and applied for it and waited for the response back. We've been working for this, said Houston coach Kelvin Sampson, whose team is coming off a Final Four and Elite Eight trip the past 2 seasons. But remember, it's a rental. You don't own it. You're just renting it because someday somebody else is going to be number one. North Carolina has been number one all season, but the Tar Heels lost to Iowa State and in a 4-overtime thriller to Alabama at the Phil Knight Invitation to cede the top spot in Houston, which bent Kent State in its only last week. North Carolina has been number one all season, but the Tar Heels lost to Iowa State and in a 4-overtime thriller to Alabama at the Phil Knight Invitation to cede the top spot at Houston, which beat Kent State in its only game last week. The last time the Cougars ascended to number one was the final poll of the 1982-1983 season, when the Guild and the Dream, along with coach Guy Lewis, were the favorite to win it all. They rolled through the NCAA tournament before falling to Jim Valvano and North Carolina State in an iconic championship game in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Brazil edges Switzerland. With injured Neymar sidelined, Brazil advances. DOHA Qatar. Brazil struggled without Neymar at the World Cup on Monday. Still, the 5-time champions played well enough to secure a spot in the next stage. Brazil overcame the absence of its injured star to beat Switzerland 1-0 and make it to the round of 16 with a match to spare in Group G. Casemiro scored the 83rd minute to break the deadlock in the game, which Brazil had difficulties creating, scoring chances without its main playmaker. We knew that it wasn't going to be easy. We had to be patient, Casemiro said. Our first objective was to advance, and we achieved that. Neymar stayed at the team's hotel treating a right ankle injury sustained in the opener in Qatar. Team doctors have not yet given a timetable on his return, or said if he will return at all. We know that Neymar is a great player and that he makes a difference, Brazil defender Marquinhos says. In difficult moments, he takes on the responsibility and creates the opportunities, but we showed once again that we have quality players to make up for his absence. Switzerland, which had no attempts on target, needs a win in the last match against Serbia to guarantee its spot in the next stage. A draw may be enough depending on the match between Brazil and Cameroon. Cameroon staged an impressive comeback for the draw against Serbia despite replacing its goalkeeper the last minute. Andre Onana, who plays for Italian club Inter Milan, wasn't in Cameroon lineup or even at the stadium to watch Group G match. Coach Rigobert Song said he dropped his starting goalkeeper for disciplinary reasons but didn't give any specifics. Song replaced Onana with Devis Epasi, who made only his sixth international appearance. Song said Onana hasn't been kicked out of the squad and didn't rule him out of Cameroon's last group stage match against Brazil on Friday. Mohamed Kudus scored twice, including the go-ahead goal after the South Koreans evened the match in the second half, and Ghana staved off elimination. Mohamed Salis also scored for the Black Stars. Portugal became the third team to reach the round of 16. Bruno Fernandes curled in a cross from the left that barely went over the head of Cristiano Ronaldo and bounced into the far corner of the net in the 45th minute. Fernandes added a second from the penalty stop in stoppage time after a handball by Jose Maria Gimenez. On the pitch, announcer fired for remarks. Former Germany forward Sandro Wagner is under fire for a disparaging remark he made about Qatari men's traditional attire while commentating for TV during Germany and Spain's World Cup match on Sunday. Wagner was commentating on the team's 1-1 draw for German broadcaster SDF when he said in the 79th minute he thought one end of the Albert Stadium in Alcor was full of German fans. Only then did I realize they are Qatari bathrobes, Wagner said. Wagner was referring to the thawb, the traditional white full-length robes with long sleeves worn by many men in the region. Wagner's comments led to furious reactions on social media. ZDF replied to some of the complaints on Twitter with a short statement. Sandro Wagner's comments about the thawb unfortunately occurred during an emotional phase of the game. He's not permitted to say that. We'll talk about it. Kane cleared. Harry Kane will be available to start for England in the team's final World Cup group game against Wales. The striker took a hit on his ankle in England's opening game against Iran and looked off the pace in the 0-0 draw with the United States on Friday. Gavi Hurt. Teenager Gavi Hurt did not practice with Spain on Monday, a day after the team's draw with Germany. Gavi was nursing a minor injury sustained in the 1-1 draw. The 18-year-old midfielder was substituted in the 66th minute against Germany. The injury was not expected to keep Gavi from being able in the final group match against Japan on Thursday. U.S. has clear World Cup task against Iran. Win or go home. The task is clear for United States. Beat Iran in a politically charged World Cup match or go home. We have to get out of our group by all means, U.S. Captain Tyler Adams said Monday. It would feel like a success for us when we make it out of the group and then continue on in this tournament. A draw or a loss Tuesday night would eliminate the Americans, who tied Wales 1-1 and England 0-0. England leads Group B with 4 points, followed by Iran with 3, the U.S. with 2, and Wales with 1. During unusual pre-match news conferences, Adams was asked to defend the U.S. treatment of black people and chastised for pronouncing the opponents Iran instead of Iran. American coach Greg Berhalter was questioned about U.S. immigration and naval policy and apologized for the U.S. soccer federation's decision to strip the emblem of the Islamic Republic from Iran's flag on social media. The USSF's flag decision was meant to support women protesters in Iran. We had no idea about what U.S. soccer put out, Berhalter said. All we can do on our behalf is apologize on behalf of the players and the staff. Iran coach Carlos Quiroz was queried about Sunday's flag flap, which promoted the governing body of Iranian soccer to demand FIFA expel the U.S. from the tournament. He said he did not intend to use the controversy as motivation. If after 42 years in this game as a coach, I still believe I could win games with those mental games, I think I did not learn nothing about the game, he said. We have solid solidarity with the humanitarian cause all over the world, whatever they are or who they are, he added. If you talk about human rights, racism, kids that die in schools with shootings, we have solidarity to all those causes. But here our mission is to bring the smiles for the people for at least 90 minutes. Adams, who is black and grew up in a white family, was told by a reporter from Iran's press about the pronunciation of Iran and then asked, are you okay with two representing a country that has so much discrimination against black people. My apologies on the mispronunciation of your country, Adams responded. That being said, there's discrimination everywhere you go. One thing I've learned, especially from living abroad the past year and having to fit in different cultures and assimilating to different cultures, is that the U.S. were continuing to make progress every day. Iran famously beat the U.S. 2-1 in a 1998 World Cup match against France that eliminated the Americans. That game just sticks in my mind. It burns in my mind, Berhalter said. What I saw from the opening whistle is one team that really wanted to win the game and one team that didn't really want to win the game. Iran rebounded from a 6-2 opening match loss to England with a 2-0 upset of Wales, putting the team in position to advance for the first time in 6 World Cups. Quirez praised the growth in the U.S. team, saying this World Cup showed they jumped from soccer to football. He coached Major League Soccer's Metro Stars in 1996 and served as a USSF advisor in 1998, writing a player development blueprint aimed at winning a World Cup by 2010. World Cup frenzy puts strain on Qatar's camels. Janine stretched out on the sand and closed his eyes, but there was little time to rest for the camel. World Cup fans coming up in droves to the desert outside Doha were ready for their perfect Instagram moment, riding a camel on the rolling dunes. As Qatar welcomes more than 1 million fans for the month-long World Cup, even its camels are working overtime. Visitors in numbers, the tiny Emirate has never before seen, are rushing to finish a bucket list of Gulf tourist experiences between games, ride on a camel's back, take pictures with falcons, and wander through the alleyways of traditional markets. On a recent Friday afternoon, hundreds of visitors in soccer uniforms or draped in flags waited for their turn to mount the humped-backed camels. Camels that did not rise were forced up by their handlers. When one camel let out a loud grunt, a woman from Australia shrieked, "It sounds like they're being violated." Nearby, a group of men from Mexico dressed in white Qatari thobes and headdresses took selfies. "It's really an amazing feeling because you feel so tall," 28-year-old Juan Gall said after his ride. The Argentine fan was visiting Qatar for a week from Australia. Cashing in on the opportunity are the animals' handlers, who, thanks to the World Cup, are making several times more than they normally would. "There's a lot of money coming in," said Ali Jabbar Ali, a 49-year-old Bendonian camel herder from Sudan. "Thank God, but it's a lot of pressure." Ali came to Qatar 15 years ago, but he has worked with camels since he was a child. On average weekday before the World Cup, Ali said his company would offer around 20 rides per day and 50 on weekends. Since the World Cup started, Ali and the men he works with are providing 500 rides in the morning and another 500 in the evening. The company went from having 15 camels to 60, he said. "Tour guides want to move things fast," Ali said, "so they add pressure on us." As crowds formed around them, many camels saw statue-like with cloth muzzles covering their mouths and bright saddles on their bodies. The smell of dung filled the air. Like other Gulf cultures, camels once provided Qataris a vital form of transportation and helped in the exploration and development of trade routes. Today, the ungulates figure into cultural pastimes. Camel racing is a popular sport that takes place on old school tracks outside the city. Ali said he knows when an animal is tired, usually if it refuses to get up or sits back down after rising to its feet. He can identify each camel by its facial feature. "I am Badan. I came from a family of Badans who care for camels. I grew up loving them," Ali said. But the sudden rise in tourists means the less time the to rest between rides, he said. A short ride lasts just 10 minutes, while longer ones run 20 to 30 minutes long. Normally, Ollie said camels can rest after 5 rides. Now people are saying we can't wait because they have other plans. They need to go in the middle of the desert, he said. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 29th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Allie Wixom from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.